Good evening and welcome. We will call to order the meeting of the San Francisco Ethics Commission. Thank you for your cooperation in scheduling and the later time tonight. Let me begin with the roll call. Commissioner Harriman?
Present.
Commissioner Ward?
Here.
Commissioner Hansen?
Present.
Commissioner Herr?
Here.
Thank you very much all for being here. Let me mention before the proceedings get underway, in case this affects anyone's plans for the evening, that item 3, consideration of ethics complaint number 01100115 regarding the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force and the Library Commission will not be on the agenda this evening due to illness. We will reschedule it for the first available date, which we expect to be the November meeting. And apologize to anyone who is inconvenienced by that change. We'll now return to item number 2, public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda within the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission. Would anyone like to take advantage of that opportunity for comment?
Good evening, members of the Ethics Commission. My name is Ray Hartz, and I am director of San Francisco Open Government. This is my first opportunity to appear before you and speak to you. And based on my experience over the last year attending a number of other meetings of various boards and commissions throughout the city, I will be here each and every week for the foreseeable future. The reason I say that is because each and every one of the boards and commissions I've attended, including the Rent Stabilization Arbitration Board, the Board of Appeals, Sunshine Ordinance Task Force, the Police Commission, the Library Commission, and so forth, all make it a big point to put on their agenda that that you should know your rights under Sunshine. The unfortunate part is when you attend the meetings, both in participating in the meetings and watching others, you see that their hold on the law is actually tenuous at best and a willful disregard of the law at the worst. The way I express it is, we'll follow it if we must, we'll evade it if we can. Give you an example. Rent Stabilization and Arbitration Board does not record their meetings, so there is no official record. And when I took them to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force and got a determination that they should, they sent a letter to the task force saying, we'll look into it, and they still haven't done it. They know it's public policy, they know it's the law of the city of San Francisco, but they simply refuse to do it. Police Commission, I attended 2 meetings recently, one in September, one in October. 5 times during 5 different public comments, I was interrupted by the same member of the police commission. Each and every time we went through an argument about what he said, I was allowed to say to the commission. Each and every time I was eventually allowed to continue. Now, one of the things I would like to say is I really do believe in the Constitution. I took an oath when I joined the military to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And that's just not me, that's for everybody. As Voltaire said, I may not agree with what a man has to say, but I will defend to the death his right to say it. Each and every commission member of each and every board in this city takes an oath when they accept their positions to support and defend the same Constitution, and they understand that it is the law of the city of San Francisco that public comment is a right of the citizens of the city of San Francisco. And yet they, unfortunately, will arrange agendas so that it is inconvenient for people to make comments, like the police commission. They will put 3 of the main items, including one time they put an election of officers, after they have a closed session. I think they do it knowing full well that they will go into closed session for 3-4 hours, and all the members of the public are going to just get tired and go home. The last time they did it, they had 3 agenda items, which they shifted without notification to the end of the agenda after the closed session, and came back 4 hours later and completed the agenda in 9 minutes. So there's a real bad and low level of understanding of the Sunshine Ordinance throughout the city. I think part of it has come down to the fact that since 1999, not one determination of theirs has ever been enforced. And I think the city has accepted that fact and said, we can get away with this because nobody's going to say anything.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hartz. Appreciate it. Are there any other comments? Thank you.
For the record, I'm Charlie Marsteller here representing myself tonight. I just had two things to mention. One is I see the reference to Prop N on the fourth item, which is the contractor prohibition. And I believe that was put on the ballot by the Oaks Commission and by, as my memory is correct, not by the board. And I don't believe it was part of Prop N. It was another proposition. I believe it was Prop O. I may be wrong on that, but I just thought I'd clarify that period of history because I was chairman of the Prop N steering committee, and I don't remember this provision. I remember the Oaks Commission coming in from L.A., I believe it was, and putting this on our ballot. The second thing I wanted to refer to you is this. I've always felt it was problematic when this body wants to bring before the Board of Supervisors its own initiated legislation that you don't have standing before the board to sponsor that bill under your own name. As I understand it, it would simply be a matter of the change of the board rules given your charter provision to allow you to bring your own legislation forth. You could raise that with the president of the board and ask whether or not that's a matter that they wish to bring up within the board itself. But I've always thought it was problematic for this body to draft something and then throw it to the Board of Supervisors, because then there may be some jockeying for political currying or favoritism or some other political dynamic that goes on where that may taint what it is you're trying to accomplish, to maintain it as an objective piece of legislation, a reform that you're bringing forward under your charter mandate. And I don't want to see us walking into a political football game at some point in the future. That has happened in the past, and I've always seen potentials for problems. So I think you should have, I've always felt that you should have, through a simple amendment of the board rules, the ability to bring forth your own legislation when it's a reform under your charter mandate.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comment about that. Anybody else like to make a comment at this time? Thank you. Seeing none, we will move to item four, consideration of possible amendments to section 1.1126 of the Campaign and Governmental Conduct Code regarding campaign contributions by city contractors. We've all had the opportunity to look at the memorandum. I'll go right to commissioner comments and questions unless Mrs. St. Croix, you or the staff would like to introduce anything here or summarize for us.
I think we're okay.
Okay. Commissioners? Questions? Thoughts? Commissioner Herr?
One question I had was whether this could be tailored in some way toward excluding contracts that otherwise are put through a competitive bidding process, because to me that seemed to be one of the best sort of prophylactic measures to prevent pay-for-play type activity, and sort of singling that out as an exception may help avoid additional unnecessary paperwork over certain contracts. Was that considered by the staff?
No, actually. And I couldn't tell you precisely what percentage of city contracts are competitively bidded as opposed to sole source or whatever, ongoing we have. If you wanted us to, we could go back to the drawing board, draw that in, and redo our conclusions to see how that would work out on the impact on this. Ultimately, we're trying to reduce paperwork loads for a bunch of people, mm-hmm. because we've got a lot of records, and it's, not that they don't contain information, it's just how much effort goes into them and how useful it is that we're trying to scale back on. But if that's what the commission wants, we can certainly recast it with that information.
Okay. I mean, I'll let others speak on that. I did have another question. I don't know whether I should wait or...
Does anybody want to address... I think that's a helpful way to do it. Does anybody else want to address the question that Commissioner Herr raised? Could you just tell us what... I realize it's open for discussion and you didn't get more information, but what your suggestion would be for us to consider to limit only to competitive contracts? Or
No. I have some concern with one of these others, but for most of the criteria, I agree that these should be excluded. But in addition, if there are contracts that go through a competitive bidding process, as described, some of which are described in the memo, that seems to me to be sort of another avenue of further limiting the contracts that would go through, that would be required to be filed under this 1.126.
Yeah, I guess I don't know enough to know if that would serve the purpose of this law or not. I'd be curious, one, is the percentage of those contracts, but two, as to whether if there is a competitive bidding process, would people still be tainted by the fact that one of the entities in the competitive bidding process is someone who had paid a lot of money to a campaign or some such thing? It just strikes me that it could be over-inclusive, but I don't know. I would need a lot more information. I certainly would be willing to look at that information, but I don't have an opinion at this point one way or the other.
Mr. St. Croix, could you just tell us whether there's a reason that the timing would matter in terms of going back and looking into this question further? Is there any forcing event or reason that it...
No, there's not an element driving this, an element of time driving this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just the burden continues on both the filers and the staff, but that could be finite.
But it doesn't strike me that there's nothing wrong with going forward tonight and still looking separately at that question, the question that Commissioner Herr raises, right?
Or we can also do it that way, yeah. And I should point out that these decision points are individual actions, so you can adopt some of them and not others, right. And we don't, it's that they're not dependent on one another.
So that's how we could, we act on them individually and we could return and expand them in that regard if we want without holding up the whole package.
Whatever way is more satisfactory to you all.
Are there any
I think that makes sense in part because, kind of like Commissioner Herrmann, I'm not sort of committed to saying that that's the right thing to do, but I think some additional investigation might be helpful.
Okay. Are there any other comments on that particular proposal?
Just briefly, I guess I need more information because I'm not seeing that there would be a difference. My understanding is that certainly we have some sole source contracts, but I believe that most contracts have to go through an open bidding contract process, taking into account MBE, WBE, all the various requirements of the city, so maybe not fully open. But it seems to me that if we're going to deal with grants and contracts and agreements, at least initially, I would think they'd all need to be dealt with the same way. My initial thought.
Do you want to move to the other point that you wanted to raise?
Sure. Mm-hmm. My second point or question was regarding decision point number one and the nonprofit organization exemption. And I guess my question was what the rationale was for exempting nonprofits. Was it just that the thought being the nonprofit, by virtue of its organizational structure, would not profit from a pay-for-play type activity? Was that the idea?
No.
Okay.
The The issue with this, and this is probably the one where we've gotten the most negative feedback, or the largest amount, yeah, is that there are a lot of nonprofits in this city that get city money, that get other monies through the city, a lot. And it's a politically active city. So you have an awful lot of politically active people who serve on these boards of directors are being told that they can't make political contributions, and they have a problem with that. For various arguments that they bring up, you know, limitations on their ability to participate in the process and also participate in community activity, is an argument that we've sort of heeded that it could limit the pool of people available for nonprofit boards to do that work, because if you choose people to do one or the other, many of them would opt for the political option rather than the civic option. And then there's the question of the sheer size of it and the manageability. How do we track all of the members of nonprofits? And I suspect, for example, that a lot of these folks are making contributions now, unaware that there's a prohibition against it. I haven't seen wide evidence of it, but I don't have the manpower to do the kind of line-by-line auditing we need to do with these reports and contribution reports to match them up.
So then I understand that there is that it's logistically more difficult, but is there some reason we don't have a concern that there is or could be pay-to-play type problems regarding nonprofits? Because they're obtaining and seeking large contracts, yeah, that do, you know, for which there could be this same problem.
Well, there's a rebuttable presumption that people that are involved in good works are less likely to be involved in chicanery.
Well, there's less of an interest of personal profit if it's a nonprofit, right? That's, you're not talking about someone who has a financial stake in the business that you would have in a for-profit corporation.
I think in one, certainly that people don't have the take home the profits of the business at the end of the cycle interest that they do in private businesses. And I'm not speaking for or against, but there is a relationship between the resources available to a nonprofit and its ability to compensate its senior staff who are covered by this, the headache of being on the board and having to make up the difference if you don't get support from the city. So it is not a direct take-home profit connection to the city's decision about whether that nonprofit gets funded, but there is a benefit in a number of other ways that could be of a degree to potentially influence people's actions. And even if it didn't influence their actions, to create a perception among the public. I'm not speaking against the proposal, because I think the key thing is, as with so many of these, it's a cost-benefit analysis, and Commissioner Herr asked a very good second question, which is, what do we know about whether we have a different kind of problem or a different degree of exposure? And I don't know if you can speak to our experience or our sense of what's out there or any way of helping us understand what the risk is that we in the city would take if we exempt these organizations relative to the, I thought, you know, meaningful burden that it places on the ability, already challenging, to get board members for nonprofit organizations given the many other responsibilities they have. I'm looking at least two other colleagues who are involved with nonprofit organizations know, you know, those balances as well. Any thoughts on the risk side?
Well, the way I look at the world, anytime there's money involved, there's risks for corruption. So the question is the potential for corruption here. How much of a conflict of interest is there? The city has an interest in following money, and that's the way the laws are crafted. But this is a collection of data that's going to be available but probably not used. And we're talking about a need to consistently inform an ever-changing set of bodies of people according to rules, you know, that are coming and going on boards of directors about these limitations on their ability to contribute. So we're going to get a lot of lists of names of people that are associated with these groups that aren't allowed to contribute. That's somewhat of a burden on every organization. We're happier to place it on the profit-oriented organizations than the nonprofits, whose money could arguably be used better. And the work that it would take to police this would be incredible. So I don't think we're going to do it. In fact, I know we're not going to do it with the manpower we have. If someone filed a complaint that this was being violated, we would have the information available to us so we could cross-check fairly quickly whether a violation would take place and notify the parties involved. And depending on the seriousness of the infraction, you know, follow through with penalties.
That in and of itself, though, I think is a deterrent. If a nonprofit knows that, although they probably won't be audited sort of at random, if there is some complaint that there is a record, I think that does create a deterrent effect that's absent if, you know, that no records have at all. One thing I was thinking about was whether the limit for nonprofit contracts could be higher. For example, rather than exempting nonprofits entirely, say that unless the contract, they're exempt unless the contract exceeds $250,000 or $150,000 or some amount whereby at the point at which it would become worth it for, quote-unquote, worth it for corrupt practices to occur, that we have some measure or some mechanism to prevent that behavior.
I take it that any of this restriction on either nonprofit or on for-profit corporations, because it potentially interferes with a person's right to contribute to a political campaign, is potentially suspect and unconstitutional. Without the distinction between profit and for-profit. Is that right, John? That distinction doesn't matter for judging whether it violates the First Amendment.
Right. Any court who looks at this law will analyze the law the same, but there may be, as Mr. St. Croix pointed out, there may be compelling interest that the city has in applying the pay-to-play law to for-profit entities as opposed to nonprofit entities, and that would all be taken into account. The same test applies.
Mm-hmm. And my opinion is that there's just not the same motivation for nonprofit board members to induce city officials to make grants to their organization in the same way that it is for-profit board members who are being paid, who may own stock that's affected by, you know, a city contract or something. It's just not the same motivation. And I would think that the public policy would favor participation in both the political process as well as, you know, civic endeavors such as serving on nonprofit boards. You just don't hear about nonprofit board members doing this type of thing. I mean, you don't hear about it. So.
Commissioner Ward, I sit on a nonprofit as well, and I understand. I agree that the motivations are different. I guess, in some sense, my concern is there's a pot of money with public trust, and you know, I kind of feel like anybody could be subject to. If the amounts are big enough, could be subject to some.
Well, the amounts are not going to get any. I mean, they're not going to get any bigger. I mean, you do have nonprofits who get pretty sizable grants from the city, depending on the type of service that the city is asking them to provide in place of the city providing the service directly themselves. And so I don't think that it's not going to change, you know, in terms of the type of contracts that are let to nonprofits by what we do here. So, you know, and doesn't seem to me that there is a problem that exists in the nonprofit community with trying to influence public officials who are letting grants mm-hmm. by somehow paying them off. You just don't hear about it.
I agree with that.
Could I just ask Commissioner Hurt, is that though why you would want a higher threshold in terms of the amount for nonprofits?
Well, right, to reduce the burden on the nonprofits while also making it such that they're not completely exempt from right. the process.
If I could just add, I think there are a couple of issues here. One is, do we treat nonprofits the same as for-profit entities? And we had a very long conversation about this whenever this first came up. And I think in some sense, fairness seem to dictate that we treat all organizations the same, for-profit and nonprofit. At the same time, I think Commissioner Ward very articulately spoke to the difference in motivation for why people are on nonprofit boards and on for-profit boards. The other issue, though, is enforcement. And it at the time that this first arose, we were not enforcing it. We made a decision to enforce it, which clearly upset many people. We realized that we couldn't really enforce it, and what I'm hearing tonight is that we're not going to enforce it if we keep this, that is just a decision that has essentially been made. We don't have the resources. We have no ability to enforce this particular provision. Is that correct?
Well, there's... What we weren't enforcing before was the actual reporting requirements.
Right.
We have begun enforcing that. We'll continue to do that. We're not going to then take the information provided and run it against all of our other reports to see if there's names on both of them. Mm-hmm. You know, if there was some way to, like, run a program or something like that, it would be different. But we don't have that.
So in that sense, I would not hear that as a deterrent. We make people report, but without an enforcement mechanism, you know, will people take it seriously? I certainly heard from folks I haven't heard from in a while, but I believe some people are here tonight specifically to speak to this provision, so maybe we want to hear from those folks. But I heard from people who said, you're not going to enforce this, and I'm going to continue to...
I don't know if I have. Can we see? I want to see if it's mine. If it is, I apologize. I don't think so.
I'm turned off.
Car.
I heard from people who said I'm going to continue to make political contributions because this makes no sense to me, and you're not going to enforce it. So I don't know if that's true. I don't know if people are doing that, but certainly that's what I was told.
And, I mean, to be honest, this is the first time I've weighed in on that particular thing. I think it's been described as unenforceable a lot of the time.
Yes.
So I think that's where people are getting that notion from.
But in the press, it's unenforceable. Yeah. We haven't said no, that's not true.
Commissioner Hansen, I was considering seeing if the commission would like to take public comment before we make a motion, if that's procedurally acceptable, so that we can hear the whether there are any additional comments from the folks who've come that might be helpful to us. Mm-hmm. If that's not acceptable, then we could, okay. Otherwise, we could take a motion and hear from folks and withdraw it if we wanted. But I'd like to hear any additional comments or questions that the board members have, because that might tell the members of the public what we are grappling with and what we'd like to hear about. And then it seems that people are comfortable with the idea of taking comment on this issue. and then we can decide how we want to proceed this evening. Okay. Anybody else on the commission like to?
Can I ask, do you just want to focus on the nonprofit issue for now and then have public comment on that issue, or do you want to cover all 5 points?
I think doing just that one might be helpful because we're focusing on it, and then we can do the whole remainder of the group rather than bouncing around. So with that, we would be interested in public comment on decision point one. If there's anyone who'd like to speak to, as many of you as would like to speak to that and help us with our thinking. Thank you.
My name is Esther Marks, and thank you, Commissioner Ward, for your comments. I am disturbed by Commissioner Herr's comments. I feel that it is a civic responsibility for people to serve on nonprofits. It's a betterment to society. And it's unfortunate that you want to put up barriers to service on a nonprofit board. I can't even think of a single board that provides a pay incentive to sit on the board. It's an act of love and civic responsibility, purely that. There is no financial gain. And you want to encourage it. I feel that that's everyone's civic responsibility, and I want you to serve on a nonprofit board so that you can give something back. By the same token, I think it's important that everyone participate in the democratic process, and that includes making contributions, no matter how small a person can afford, but participating financially in candidates and issues that you believe in. All these are important values and goals of our society and our democracy. And I really am offended that you want to promote a policy which is contrary to these values.
Good evening, Commissioners. Anita Mayo, Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shaw, Pittman. I agree with staff that the proposed amendment should be adopted. The law has created a great deal of confusion in the regulated community and can easily result in noncompliance by those who don't have ready access to political law counsel. As staff states in its memo, the law has had an unintended negative impact on those volunteers who serve on the boards of various nonprofit organizations, which receive grants and contracts from the city. Essentially, these volunteers must choose between serving their communities on a nonprofit board and their constitutional right to participate in the political process by making campaign contributions to candidates whom they support.
Thank you very much.
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director, San Francisco Open Government. As I said in my open comments, my main concern is open government issues. However, as long as I'm going to attend commission meetings, I also pay attention to some of the things that I hear in the meetings and comment on them. In this particular case, it's this sort of a pie-in-the-sky thing that people who serve on nonprofits do it only for the good of the community. I think we all know that people serve on boards for a lot of different reasons. They serve on boards to make contacts, which can help their business. They make contacts that will help get things done, certain things. You know, there are a lot of different reasons. And simply taking this sort of everybody must do it only for the benefit of the community is, I think, unrealistic. I think there are a lot of people in the private sector especially who will volunteer to serve on a board because there is an additional benefit other than simply saying I have done public service. They, as I said, can make contacts and do other things. And just the idea of using this, we can all sort of make this sort of, a myth? I can't think of the actual term, but it's a myth that really isn't true. It just has gotten currency because everybody says so.
Urban legend.
Urban legend. Thank you very much. I would have believed that the members of the Board of Appeals, in accordance with the California Code, are required to know something about local business building code or local building codes and so forth. And I find out recently that that's not the case. City attorney says the only qualification is that they meet the city's qualification, which is you have to be representative of the community, which means you have to be basically a warm body. So they basically get on the board, they serve there. The only thing they can do is rubber stamp what the city recommends to them. And as a result, you see things like Jimmy Jen, the permit expediter, who basically puts through 500 different documents which have forged signatures, falsified stamps, et cetera, on 100 different projects, and you get the department saying, oh, well, no big deal. It's not problematic, were the exact words used. And the board, because none of them have any experience which will help, with exception of one commissioner who has a bachelor's and a master's in architecture, basically can't have no knowledge or educational background or any other grounds on which they can do anything except take what the city department says and go with it. And this is the same city department that let the 500 documents go through, some of which had to have been included in cases heard before the Board of Appeals. So again, I'm you know, hey, nonprofits aren't always 100% made up of only people with purely altruistic motives. Sometimes there are people there who are doing it because they can benefit from it. And trying to differentiate the two is kind of an odd thing. The second thing, and I think more important, is that this law is here. I think most people are going to assume, another urban legend, that you're actually going to enforce it. And what I'm hearing from your comments is, well, we're going to collect a whole bunch of documents, but we're not actually going to do anything with them.
Thank you.
Charles Marsteller again for the tape. I wanted to say that there is not a firewall between in the city's practices regarding nonprofits, because there are provisions in, for instance, the Sunshine Ordinance that requires nonprofits open up their meetings or open up certain aspects of their procedures and practices and their books to the public when public funds are involved. So the ice has been broken. That was put through largely at the behest of Mr. Brugman, who was a very strong advocate with The Guardian on this issue. You may be hearing further from Mr. Brugman in the media, my guess is. I would also raise the question of whether or not, again, you are fundamentally not charged with the prospects of furthering the purposes of an act, and you want to be careful that what you do don't curtail essentially the purposes of the act, especially when it's a voter-approved provision. I assume this is going to require a supermajority of this body and the Board of Supervisors to enact. So that will give certain safeguards to the public interest, I think. But I'm just pointing these issues out because they may come up.
Commissioners?
I will move that we adopt decision point 1A.
A second.
Is there any further discussion by the commissioners? In that case, we'll take a vote on
this. Any public comment?
Oh, okay.
You had a public comment on 1A.
Okay.
Okay. For the record, let me just note, the question was raised whether we needed to resolicit public comment since we haven't changed anything that we did before or after the what's on the table, and we secured public comment on this item. We can go forward now to a vote unless any of the commissioners have something additional they'd like to say or ask.
I just had a question that I think, just for the record, should be answered. Commissioner Ward noted this, and I think we've heard this before, that there has not ever been a problem that has come to our attention with regard to nonprofits in this provision. And I just want to make sure that that is correct in terms of we haven't received a complaint, we haven't heard that there's been a pay-to-play issue involved. Do we have a record at all that there has been a problem that we are now not addressing, basically,
among all those complaints that we have adjudicated and resolved now? I cannot comment on anything current, any currently existing complaints.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
With that, the commissioners will vote on the motion that's been made and seconded on decision point one. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 The motion was, decision point one was unanimously passed.
Just want to point out that 1B is current policy, but it's not currently codified.
So are you suggesting that we vote separately on 1B?
Yeah.
I made a motion on 1A.
Yep.
You
mm-hmm.
just...
But
okay.
It's... Yeah. It's not introducing something new. It's already in the policy of the commission. So
okay. In that case, let's see if there's any discussion on it. Then we'll take a motion and take public comment on 1B, which we have not addressed with the public. Any comments or questions about 1B, which, as Mr. St. Croix indicates, is a codification of present practice? Do I hear a motion?
I'll move that we adopt decision point 1B.
Second.
Public comment on this item? Seeing none, we will vote on decision point 1B. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you. Okay. Moving to, naturally, decision point 2. Regards deletion of a phrase quoted there, the phrase being a state agency on whose board an appointee of a city elective officer serves. Do we have discussion or questions about that proposed change?
I have a comment. I have a concern about this one. We previously talked about this a bit, and again, I think that there are members of the public here to talk about this. Various state agencies that are listed, and I'm looking at page 3, are some of the largest contractors. And they're contrary to, I think, the history with regard to nonprofits. There has been a history of problems related to state agency appointees. For example, Ben Hom, who was appointed to the Redevelopment Commission, actually lost his seat on the Redevelopment Commission in part because he solicited from a developer appearing before the Redevelopment Commissioner contributions to Mayor Jordan. So while I don't think there's been a large body of evidence, I don't think it's as simple as it sounds that these are state agencies, so therefore it's not an issue. These are very large agencies that have very large contracts, and I think the potential for pay to play, if you will, is it certainly exists, and we've seen that in the past. So again, I'd be interested in public comment. I know Mr. Marstiller had some previous comments when we last discussed this.
Commissioners, any other comments or questions at this time? Okay. Then let's hear, in fact, whether there's public comment on this item, decision point 2.
Commissioners, just very briefly, I would say that one of the most difficult provisions for compliance is the one which prohibits contributions when the contract is with a state agency and an appointee of an elected official sits on the agency's board. Your average citizen and candidate has no clue that because an appointee of an elected official is a member of that state agency, that a contractor and its affiliated persons, and that's all those people, the board members, the CFO, COO, are prohibited from making a contribution to that officer or to even the candidate for that office during that prohibited period. It's just very confusing for the average person to understand this provision.
There have been cases, in fact, where appointments have been made that had nefarious consequence downstream, and more than once, and sometimes involving the same party. And Commissioner Hansen mentioned one party in particular that was widely reported in the press, and there's quite a history, extensive press history on that. I think it raises a larger question, and that is whether or not in your strategic planning process that you might calendar this matter for whether or not this would be an area in which the commission would want to seek additional staffing, whether there's enough incidence history. I don't know what may be pending or what has happened in the past, because that's in your purview and not as public in all cases, unless it does hit the press. But there has been smoke, so there may be, in fact, enough data that could be assembled to generate a file that would indicate that additional staffing ultimately in this direction is needed, so that, in fact, that the law could be enforced, at which time maybe then the law would need to be amended back. I see the dilemma you're in now, and if anything, the city is moving in the wrong direction, probably fiscally, for some of these things to happen, and I don't see any remedies for tax revenue or revenue sources to offset these costs. So my thought is that this might be a strategic planning conference matter, and it might be some direction in which additional staffing would ultimately be needed for the commission. But I can understand what the staff director is recommending to you at this time.
Commissioners?
I guess just looking at this, my problem is just simply how people are going to know that they're not allowed to make a political contribution. I just think it's going to leave a lot of people without any clue that they're violating the law. And that's what bothers me about this particular provision. I'm sort of sympathetic to the concern Commissioner Hansen raised. I think it's a good one, and Mr. Marsteller as well. But I really worry about having the average voter not know that they're prohibited from making a contribution, and I want the average voter to feel free to make political contributions. That's the dilemma, I guess.
Commissioner Ward?
Well, I guess I look at this a bit differently, in that, one, a person who is appointed to a state commission is not generally the average.
That's not the person I'm concerned with. So I'm concerned more with the person, the contracting party, someone who's doing work and then has no clue that their contract involves a state agency on whose board some city elective sits. It's definitely not that person.
Right.
Yeah, I'm with you on the other side of it, the other side of the coin.
I have the same feeling. Both on the commission and from the comments, we're hearing that same tension between the confusion and the multi-layered sort of domino effect of who would be affected, and yet the grounds on which this was brought to us begin because there is little, if any, risk or perception that arrangements could lead to these problems has been, you know, addressed, and it seems that there are certainly the perceptions and potentially the risks or the smoke that one of our commenters referred to that makes it hard to walk away from it or to change the law in that direction. Is anyone inclined to make a motion at this point, or does anyone see a way of
I guess I'm wondering,
this needle between the two?
Is there a way to fine-tune this a little differently?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
What we are doing here, you know, primarily is looking at something that's untenable and trying to clean it up a little. I'm doing a lot of things these days because the staff is just swamped everywhere, and this particular election is very busy. So I'm trying to ease up their body of work. In choosing these eight state organizations, there's a degree of separation because they approve these contracts. They don't have to get the mayor or the board's approval to approve the contracts, even though the mayor and the board appoint them. So in order for an office holder to shake down contractors, they would have to go through an intermediary, their appointment to that commission. Obviously, we've heard that that can happen. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you know, I've got one example. I don't have a dozen. So because there's that degree of separation, our thinking is the possibility of pay-to-play happening is somewhat reduced proportionally. It's not eliminated at all. You know, and Mr. Marstel is right. You know, if we had the staff, we'd be doing all this work. It's just not going to happen anytime soon. So that's the thinking behind this. It's a tough call.
I'm going to move that we adopt the decision point, and I do it because I really don't want to interfere with somebody's right to make political contributions, and in a situation where there's just somebody could easily not know that that right's being taken away from them, and that's what concerns me. So on that basis, I'm going to move that we adopt decision point number two. And if there's no second, that resolves that.
I'll second that.
Just a point of clarification, and this applies to all the amendments to Section 1.126 as well as the subsequent amendments to the gift laws that you're going to consider in a bit. As Mr. Marsteller mentioned, these require supermajority. That's 4 votes of this commission and then 8 votes at the board.
Yeah, just want to bring it to a vote.
We understand that. Comments? Yes.
Could I ask Mr. St. Croix to speak to a couple of issues? One, enforcement of this, and two, how you would see educating appointees that they would not be allowed to make a political contribution?
Well, the people who can make contributions are all of those members of boards and senior executives of people contributing with the city. I don't have a plan to do outreach to those folks. Mm-hmm. We've sat down with city departments, and particular with these 8 several times, to work out a sort of boilerplate approach to when contracts are let, make sure they have this information. It should be on the RFP. In fact, it should be the cover sheet of the RFP. You know, you are entering into a point where now you are prohibited. So that's what's being done. Whether or not that's effective or not, I have no way of gauging. In terms of enforcement, again, it's going to be, we have this information. If someone has a complaint, we'll match it up. But otherwise, it's literally a person doing a line-by-line, name-by-name kind of search. So the information will be there for people who want to use it. But we're not prepared. We don't have the staff to do the constant analysis it will take to look for violations.
Just in terms of sheer numbers, mm-hmm. It would be, I presume, easier to enforce this if we were so inclined, because we're talking about a much smaller number of agencies as opposed to thousands of or hundreds of nonprofits in the city.
Are we comparing these 8 agencies to
yes.
nonprofits?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know. There's a lot at both ends.
But in this, it applies to all of the people who contract with them.
Those 8 agencies. Those 8
state
agencies.
Those 8 agencies.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we know the scale mm-hmm. of that extra concentric circle.
And we would probably have to educate the agencies, and then they would have to educate the people who contract.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure how we would educate. We don't know who those people would be.
Any other comments or questions, or are we ready to vote? Okay. Is there any further public comment on the motion? It was the same. We took comment on the consent.
Now that I'm revisiting some of these issues in my head, because it dates 15 years back, I do remember being thankful that we were not the ones proposing this in 1995 for reasons I think that are becoming obvious to you. At the time, there was discussion about this group coming in from Los Angeles and proposing this, and we wondered about the tenability of enforcement from a technical point of view, because, of course, we had scrubbed the CFRO, and we knew basically where we were going with that, and this appeared to us to be a big enigma.
I'm sorry, I didn't pay.
Enigma.
Okay.
With a lot of ramifications that, in our view, had not been carefully vetted. They, as I say, they came in and put it on the ballot. And so this, I don't mean to do a mea culpa here or whatever, but I do want to say at the time, I remember now some of the concerns about this ordinance, proposed ordinance.
Thank you. Any other comment? This is challenging. Okay, with that, we will vote on the motion to adopt decision point number two. All commissioners in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion passes 4-1 and achieves the supermajority that is needed to move it on to the next step. Let's move to decision point three that involves the scale of contracts to which section 1.126 would apply. Discussion, commissioners?
I have a question.
Sure.
I would just ask if we have any more information with regard to a record and the rationale from going to 50 to 100. I know there's language that basically says the I'm looking for it here, but kind of the general rule has been that contracts are 100,000, and I'm just curious what that's based on. You want me to find that language?
The the 100,000 figure is vaguely arbitrary in that it's just sort of the next rung on the ladder of rounded up figures, the way we tend to look at when we create this kind of legislation.
I can't resist saying that there was an op-ed piece in the New York Times yesterday on the subject of the selection of numbers having to do with the number of fingers and toes we have and days of the week. So you have done exactly what the researcher reported we all do, found the next natural notch.
Or arbitrary as a
matter. And acknowledge, right, and the op-ed and Mr. St. Croix acknowledged that these are very arbitrary measures.
Well, I'm looking for something a little less arbitrary to hang my hat on. And one of the comments is on page 9, and it says, contracts worth under 100,000 rarely require approval by elected officials. So I wonder if that is an appropriate place to start. What record do we have? What knowledge do we have to back up that statement?
Just if I trying to remember the, go ahead.
The charter requires the Board of Supervisors and the mayor to approve all contracts worth $10 million or more, or where the city has to pay $10 million or more, or where the city's expected revenues are $1 million or more, or where the term of the contract is 10 years or more. And it also requires the board and the mayor to approve modifications to those contracts if they're worth $500,000 or more. So I think that occasionally contracts go to the board or the mayor for specific reasons because the authorizing legislation requires it, or for political reasons sometimes. But the big bulk of the contracts that go to those elected officials are worth well over $100,000. Other department heads, like the city attorney, the treasurer, approve contracts of various amounts, under 50, over 50. I'm not sure how it all breaks down.
So Commissioner Hansen, can you articulate what you're looking for to, or what kind of facts might
just a rationale that is that isn't arbitrary and that's based on some kind of standard of practice?
It's not a standard per se. We're looking for ways, small ways to reduce staff burden, and so this would be
without undue exposure.
Without undoing the whole section, and in looking at this, you know, I would have gone to 250,000, and then I thought the commission won't buy that, you know. So instead of trying to reduce it workload by this much, I just went for a little less. So it is arbitrary in that it's not exactly the figure that we wanted, but it still will make a small reduction in workload.
Mr. St. Croix, along those lines, I mean, to me, this is a sort of balancing benefit and burden, and I see why you've chosen this number. Do you know how many filings we're talking about between 50,000 and 100,000? How many contracts approximately would be impacted by this?
I'm going to say from memory 5-6 dozen a year.
So there are about 600. Sorry, I'm trying to recite this from memory here.
But actually, you know, it's probably twice that, but with the adoption of decision point two, now it's about half of that. So the number I just gave you was accurate.
I see. So I should have complicated it. Independently, you're saying it would be about 100 or so contracts a year that were the only
60 or 70. I thought 60, 5 or 6 dozen.
Right, but 60 taking into account what we just done on two.
Yeah. So if we hadn't adopted two, it would have been 60, twice that much.
Okay, I see. Okay.
How many under 50? Would you say?
We don't do any under 50. Right now, 50 is the threshold.
I'm sorry. So, okay, we're just talking 50, 100 is your 5 or 6 dozen. Okay.
And it's a declining body of work because the way prices are going up, smaller contracts are sort of every year a little bit more.
Is anyone inclined to make a motion? And then we can get comments, unless on this one you prefer to do it in the opposite order.
I'll move that we adopt decision point number three.
Second.
Okay. Public comment?
This is more of a question for the MIS staff or the IT staff, ultimately for the executive through the executive director. My thought is that the way technology is moving, I know the purchaser maintains a lot of databases that I believe that the Dr. Dave Wolber was utilizing at USF, and he was taking purchaser departmental data on tapes. So I don't know what data they're making available, but there may be some resources out there. And ultimately, as you know, we go further down the road on our electronic data development. We could develop some interlocking databases that would be able to help the department in some of these areas. I just thought I would mention that because I know that there was a whole host of resources available through purchaser.
Thank you. Motion's been made and seconded that we adopt decision point number three. All commissioners in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much. We'll move to decision point number four, to allow elected officials to file consolidated reports. Questions or discussion on that item, anyone? This is described as a technical amendment that relates to streamlining the filing requirements to simplify forms.
Right now, when a board has a mayoral appointee and a board appointee, the mayor has to file this report and the clerk has to file the identical report. This would allow them to just generate a single report that they both sign.
Questions or comments? Do I hear a motion?
I move that we approve decision point 4A.
Second.
Public comment? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And decision point 4B?
Essentially says that right now the mayor and the clerk of the board have to sign these forms. This would allow them to designate someone on staff to sign for them, sign off for them.
Commissioner, comments or a motion?
Move that we adopt decision point 4B.
Second.
I'm actually looking at this one, right? A new. So do I understand that it goes from requiring the elected official, him or herself, to sign the filing?
Right.
Does it change the legal responsibility that the person has for the accuracy of the information in any way?
No. It just means because of other obligations and travel and things like that, sometimes they're supposed to be to us within a certain period of time. 10 days is my recollection, and that occasionally, just occasionally, proves problematic.
For information, currently the law allows the clerk of the board or one of the clerk's employees to file on behalf of the Board of Supervisors. I think the big problem is when the mayor approves legislation, approves the contract, only the mayor can sign the form. And this would authorize the mayor to allow one of his employees to sign. Okay.
Comment or a motion on this, on 4B? Anyone?
We made a motion, did I?
Oh, I'm
we
sorry.
Made a motion.
Okay, and I commented. Okay. Public comment then? We'll vote on 4B. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. And then the final decision item is number 5, to provide a 10-day notice requirement. Their discussion or questions on that one? Commissioner Hanson.
A question. I'd like some more information about why this is an unrealistic and unnecessary requirement, the requirement to require this before initiating contract negotiations. I think in general we try to do things as much as possible on the front end and not after the fact, so that if there's a problem early on, we can catch that as opposed to addressing it afterwards. So can you just talk about why it's unrealistic?
Well, the phrase before initiating negotiations is kind of amorphous, you know, when before, and what exactly is the initiation. So we've kind of tried to help people identify the beginning of negotiations as when you actually have your first conversation. Mm-hmm. So if you pick a specific event to start the clock ticking, rather than putting a limitation that says you can't even have that first conversation until this takes place, these negotiations don't happen overnight. So when you say, here, all right, as soon as you begin negotiations, there's a clock ticking, you've got 10 days to notify all these people. We are currently approaching negotiations. It's still very, very early in the process. So it's to us, it's just a more reasonable approach. Rather than saying before you even commence negotiations, do this first. And it's like, that's never happened before. Telling people, alert all your people that we might be doing this, and then what if the negotiations never commence, for example? It's, again, eliminating one small level of confusion.
And this is, again, it's eliminating confusion and it's eliminating burden on staff. Is that part of the rationale?
Well, this isn't lifting, this isn't a burden on a staff. It's a burden on the potential contractor. Because
but
we're
how
telling
would the potential contractor know that he or she had to do this unless the staff mm-hmm. can get to everybody who might enter into negotiations?
Right. And again, I think we talked about this in terms of the first point of contact being the first meeting. However, often there's much work that goes on before a reported meeting.
Yeah. Well, I think that at least with this, we can, over time, educate the city departments that let contracts. As soon as you start talking to somebody, make sure they know they have to do this. So... I don't think it should be incumbent upon the staff to educate the potential contractors, you know, and we don't know who they are or when they're going to approach the city, but we can tell the city as soon as you have initial contact on a contract, this is part of the education you have to give to people, which is like the notifications, for example, on RFPs and things like that. All right, you know, once you start looking at this, you have to realize you have these limitations on who you can contract with.
Are we doing this now? Are we enforcing this now? What does this look like?
I can speak to that a bit. Just the city's standard RFPs and standard contracts both include a provision about Section 1.126. Now, that doesn't mean that people know about it at the first point of contact in every case. They should know about it if they carefully review an RFP. If they're doing that before the first point of contact.
Do we know? Are people reporting? Are we getting data on this?
We don't know. We don't have a way of collecting whether contractors are telling their people about these requirements mm-hmm. or not. We have, at the point where they fill in these reports to us, the city agencies have identified the people that are supposed to be getting these warnings. Presumably, they're getting this information from the potential contractors. So that surely alerts the contractors that those people should be made aware of this.
But we don't know if that's happening, and
no,
we're
and I don't
not
have the authority
getting
to go to contractors and say, right, are you doing this?
And we have no way of enforcing it, it sounds like.
Yeah. I think that if we put this in here, eventually we can put in a process where we can follow up to see if the notification was made. You know, perhaps make it a, when you return the RFP, you have to have a written copy of a written document that you distributed or something like that.
I would just say I would hope that would be true throughout. So if we're making these changes so this is more enforceable, let's enforce it.
Oh, I understand.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Is there a motion on number 5?
Move that we adopt decision point 5.
Second.
Public comment?
Anita Mayo, Pillsbury again. I think adding the 10 days would be helpful right now with just having to notify prior to commencement of negotiations. Contractors don't really have any guidelines as to when that is to be. If you say 10 days once you start negotiations, then at least that's something tangible. Right now, they don't really have anything tangible to go by. The other point I wanted to make, and I'm not certain when to make it, is I have comments on a provision of 1.126 that's not listed in the memo, and I'm not sure when to bring those up.
Why don't we act on this one, and then, well, while you're here, why don't you go ahead and make those?
Okay. All right. The contractor ban prohibits not only contributions to an individual who holds a city-elected office or a candidate for such office, but also to a committee controlled by such individual or candidate. And the commission may wish to take this opportunity to clarify the application of the term a committee controlled by such individual or candidate. I've received numerous inquiries about whether the contractor ban applies to a San Francisco official who is raising funds for either a state or a federal office. Although the intent of the law was probably to reach only those controlled committees which qualify as San Francisco committees, The language can be construed to reach beyond the limits of San Francisco to state and even federal elections. Such an interpretation could be viewed as either unconstitutional or preempted by state or federal law, and clarity about the application of that term would be welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. We have before us a motion on decision point number 5. Any other comments or questions? Let's take a vote on that. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Okay. We've completed that. Appreciate Ms. Mayo's comment on what's not before us. Commissioner Hansen?
Sorry, yeah. Please finish what you're saying.
That's it?
I didn't know if you want to address Ms. Mayo. I would just suggest that we, if we don't address that now, that we put that on our next discussion of 1.126. It's been raised before, and I also have a concern about that.
Yeah, I was just assuming that the staff would take a look at that, and I appreciate your comment. No, I think that's that does sound like a substantive question, and I appreciate your flagging it.
I also have another question that is not in the memo, just to clarify language. We've had this question in the past about grants and contracts and whether those are both included in the same definition. And I note that we've used, when we define contract on page 2, we say contract means any agreement or contract. We use agreement or contract throughout. I mean, some of this is this current language. And then we use grants, I think, specific to and only to the issue of nonprofits. But I just wanted to make sure that we are inclusive of grants and contracts, that when we say contracts, we're talking about any agreement or contract that might include a grant.
In 2006, we amended this to extend it to grants and loans as well as contracts.
So even though the word grant is in there, we're presuming that because of the change we made in 2006?
The changes before you today, and I think this was part of decision point one.
Maybe it
wasn't part of any of the decision points. The language before you, which is on page 2 of the draft, of the draft amendments, mm-hmm. would actually delete the word grant from the definition of contract for the purpose of 1.126. I don't think that the commission has specifically voted on that.
Right.
That question today was recrafted as a question about nonprofits.
Right. And it may be that the only time we've used the word grant has to do with nonprofits, so we've taken nonprofits out. Maybe this is no longer an issue.
In my personal experience with 1.126, that's the only context in which the grants have come up ever.
Okay. I don't know if we need to look at that again or that resolves it.
However you put it.
Sorry, I have one last comment, and that is this issue that I think is still outstanding that we had previously raised with regards to whether amendments must strengthen rather than weaken our policy provisions. So Mr. Marstella raised it again tonight. I don't think we ever resolved it. We had some difference of opinion about whether what we're doing now with 1.126 follows the law, because we are weakening, by our decisions tonight, we are weakening 1.126. Now, this will probably be addressed by the board, I would assume, but
yeah.
I don't want to kind of leave that hanging out.
No, I think by making something more effective and enforceable.
You could argue,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Just an outstanding issue, I think. So I think we should just be... we should note potentially to the board that we're aware of that. That's how we construct it.
Well, they'll have a lot of questions, I'm sure.
Okay.
You want me to address that question? The answer I would give is the CFRO requires that any amendment further the purposes of the law, and for the reasons Mr. St. Croix mentioned, an amendment that scales back the law could advance its purposes. And that's really a policy judgment that this commission and the board are charged with making. So I guess that puts the question back to really the policymakers as opposed to a purely legal question.
That's his responsibility. Does anybody else have any comments on that point? Then let's move on to the next item on the agenda.
Can I recommend? I'm sorry. Before you leave,
sure,
this,
sure.
Can I recommend? Often when you adopt decision points at the end, you just say we adopt the provision as a whole. I think the decision points actually covered all the mm-hmm. all the amendments here. Yeah. Do you think that's necessary?
It's no.
We've never done that.
Okay.
Yes. Yep. And thank you all for very helpful comments on this. This is a sensitive, each of these really reflects a sensitive balancing that we're trying to do. And so this kind of input is quite helpful to us, and I appreciate all the commissioners' effort to try and find those right points during some times that are difficult. Let's move to item number five on our agenda. Do commissioners want a break, or would you like to soldier on at this point? I'm seeing soldiering as the consensus. With that, we are turning to number five regarding gifts of travel. Travel or gift cards, yes?
No, this is travel.
Travel.
Okay. This is a continuation of a discussion we've already started. Essentially, elected officials are required to report the expenses of their travel before they actually take the trip when it's being paid by a third party. The difficulty in this is they don't really know exactly what those expenses are before they take the trip. So they have to estimate them usually through a combination of guesswork and some information from the sponsors of the travel. And then they have to refile these almost exclusively, have to amend these because the numbers are approximate when they return. There is a benefit to officials reporting travel before they go in that generally it can alert the public that they're about to take a trip, which may express some sort of connections or potential conflicts or whatever, which is why they report the travel to begin with. But it's just a duplication, an automatic duplication of effort for just that one benefit, and it's problematic in particular. There's been a lot of travel by members of the board in the last year or so where they don't have a lot of advance notice. In fact, sometimes it's only 1 or 2 days they're going abroad for something. This particularly happens when some members are going on a trip and someone has to drop out for some reason and someone else takes their place. So there is a little bit of difficulty for them. And then again, it's a duplicated effort by the traveler and then again by the staff. So we think that because the public ultimately will have the access to the correct information after the travel, that's a sufficient benefit, and that we will reduce some bureaucratic requirements by shifting the onus of reporting travel and what the expenses were to after the trip is completed and the figures are accurate.
I have some questions, but let me see if other commissioners have questions or comments first. I'm just wondering whether the first set of considerations is addressed by the availability of public officials' calendars, because I do think there is a value to knowing that someone is going someplace, the purpose of the visit, and at the broad level, who is sponsoring the trip. And I can understand the complexity of having all of this information at the outset. So I'm wondering if that first need is addressed by, and I'm looking at both you and Mr. Givner, what calendar information is available. The substitute may only know a few days out, but much of the time somebody who was planning to go would know early enough that people could, who are interested in that kind of information, would have it available under other provisions. Is that general assumption correct? Do you know anything about
the
way that is would be accessible?
I believe the Sunshine Ordinance requires department heads to have calendars that are made publicly available, and I also believe that members of the board or other elected officials who aren't department heads do it as a practice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm pretty sure that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm pretty sure the electeds have to keep a public calendar.
All elected,
yes. In fact, I know they
yes,
do.
They don't
there had been something of a tussle between some folks in the community and the mayor. And there's a group called ProSF that requests the public calendar of all electeds every week, and they disseminate it to a specific audience. So the elected officials have to keep a public record. To my knowledge, however, it's not published anywhere. They just have to make it available on request.
And how detailed is it? Does it say that I'm going to Tahiti?
Or does it say I'm going to Tahiti at the
expense of
ABC Steel?
Yeah.
Well, on my calendar, I have to put when I meet, the time I'm meeting, the persons I'm meeting with, and the purpose of the meeting. It does not have to be terribly specific. If I were to accept travel on someone else's dime, I would also report that, you know, conference in D.C., these dates, sponsored by whatever foundation, purpose of the
conference. Are you required
conference.
To?
Yeah.
To say that it's on somewhat at someone else's expense?
Not on my calendar. The filing at someone else's expenses appears on my financial report. This application we're talking about today, though, is only elected officials, and they're the only ones required to file this, make this extra filing when a third party is paying. So for department heads, you don't get that information until you get it once a year. For elected officials, you get it right away.
But the calendars are required to be kept but not submitted except upon request.
That's, to my knowledge, yeah. I don't believe they're published anywhere.
Right. So we don't have any way except requests to get mm-hmm. this information. Now, the calls that I've gotten about this, which I've mentioned in these meetings, have to do with not necessarily who's sponsoring the trip, but who's attending, who's on the trip,
mm-hmm.
who are often lobbyists. And those, there's no requirement to list those people. So the issue is that an organization sponsors a trip, they invite people on the trip who then are presumed to be lobbying the elected officials. Now, when I get calls about that, it's usually in response to a press account. I don't know mm-hmm. how the press gets that information, but if they're getting it from us by this filing, then I would say it definitely serves a benefit. And before the trip, some discussion can happen. I don't know, you know, if that currently happens. I'm not sure that people are getting that information from us. But I do think there is it serves the public to know this information before the trip and happens as opposed to after it's happened and there's nothing anybody can do about it.
Okay.
Except be informed.
Yeah, and they are supposed to report city decision makers and lobbyists that accompany them. But they sometimes won't know until they actually go on the trip who's there.
Was there any consideration of doing this in two parts of a, because there are a number of things that I can understand might be hard to know accurately enough beforehand. But if there were a set of information that had to be provided before the trip, and then a report afterward, for example, the expenses.
Well, functionally, that's the way it works now. Because they report everything they know before they go.
They put a bunch of things in, say, estimated or don't know or.
Yeah. You know, and in terms of the burden, this particular issue is far less a burden on our staff than it is on the elected officials. But this is one of the things we get the most calls about advice for.
Would it ease the burden if it were a two-step process? You don't have to try to figure out what the total amount is to fund the trip. You don't have to figure out, you know, the things related that they can't possibly know ahead of time. No one's going to know the money issues ahead of time. It's impossible. If you separated that out, does that have any effect in easing the burden, or is it just the mere fact that they're filing twice that's the burden?
It makes it a little easier, but they still have to file it twice. In fact, under that situation, you're almost...
But to Commissioner Harriman's point, I mean, they wouldn't have to fill in that same information again.
Yeah, but they don't now. I can't make them fill out information they don't have.
And so we'd only require them in the first instance to do what they know, and in the second instance, presumably it's the same form it's already filled in. They just add the stuff they didn't know before.
Right.
What if
in the first round they did know it and it didn't change, they could have done it once. It's a...
But I think the point that's being made by the staff is that it's a burden on the staff to review this information twice, not that it's so burdensome on the filer, but that it's a problem for the staff because
it's actually not, I'm sorry. The staff has to take in the information twice and file it twice and upload it twice and all that. That's not so bad. That's the people who have to do the filing that have to scramble before they go to try to figure out the answers to these questions before they've been answered, and then do it again when they get back. What I could do is take this back and see if we can reconfigure the recommendation to do something along the line of what Commissioner Harriman said, get the information about the trip and who's paying for it in first, which they know, and then get the expenses and everything else, which they don't often know, later on. I think that could be a better process and would certainly, you know, ease up.
I think
but
so
what is the difference? If they're not filling in the information because they don't know it in the first instance, just not having the information on the form, they're still not going to be filling
I guess some conscientious people might be trying to find that information, even though it's, making calls, trying to get it, and then realizing that they can't find it. So if you tell them, don't worry, just get it after the trip, that type of information might, for those who are more conscientious, it might help them out.
Technically, when they don't have the information that's required of them, they're in violation, even though it's metaphysically impossible for them to get it. So if we were to take Commissioner Harriman's suggestion and reconfigure it, they could meet their filing obligations without being in violation, even though it's, as you are correct, it would essentially the same process.
Now, I think it could be a part A and a part B, tell us where you're going, sponsored by whom, for what purpose. And then part B, if you know this now, tell us now, but part B can quite happily be completed afterward. I think it's the notice and, kind of putting people on the trail if there's something about which they want to ask more questions that's more important. And yet we don't want to torture our elected officials either.
Not all of them.
I'm wondering.
As a general metaphysical principle.
I would agree. I don't think the issue is the total cost of the trip. I don't think that's what disturbs people. And I'm looking at what needs to be disclosed now. And I'm wondering if the only issue on this list is, in fact, bullet point 2 under the discussion, page 2, the total amount paid by the entity to fund the trip, et cetera, and if we could require everything else, which includes any contributor who paid more than $500 to the entity funding the trip, so you get some sense of who's helping to pay, and $500 it seems anything more than $500 seems like that information would probably be available. All the rest of this is not monetary, and it's information that I think is much more relevant in terms of who's involved, who's going on the trip, et cetera. Would that be a way of dealing with it, that we potentially just drop that second bullet point and ask for the total cost after the fact?
Well, Well, I'm certain the who's going on the trip would have to be amended each and every time, because you never know until the trip actually happens.
Right, which staff people of the funding entity actually go along.
But as an initial, you'd make your best guess. It seems unfair to ask for your best guess at the total cost of the trip, but the rest of this, it seems like there would be a pretty good idea. Some of this is going to have to be revised later, so yes, it doesn't lessen the burden necessarily, but that second bullet point seems to be the most problematic, if I'm hearing it right, and we don't even ask them to attempt it.
I guess.
Actually, that's one of the things that they can generally get an estimation of. It's the
what's the problem?
Because it's still an estimate. It's never the right amount. I hear what you're saying.
Okay.
All right. We'll do some work on it and bring it back.
Okay. I did find compelling the comment in the next last paragraph. Lastly, staff is unaware of any instances in which an interested member of the public has sought these reports prior to a trip, and that whatever the means by which the press is aware and can explore that. Also does say something about the value of putting people to this effort if people aren't asking you for it. Okay. Item number 6.
Actually, you might want to have public comment on.
Thank you. Yes, good point. I don't know why I love public comment. Is there any public comment on this item that we are proposing to revisit? Okay. Sorry. Item number 6, gift cards and gift certificates.
Okay. This is another prior discussion that we left unsolved.
You expect us to be wise and decisive this evening.
So what essentially we would like you to bring closure to us with is current practice, because the law does not address this directly. A gift card or gift certificate is considered cash right now. Staff is proposing that we subdivide them into vendor cards and general cards and have a different rule for each. What I would like you to do is either to ratify that duality, or we did not propose alternate language, but I would ask you either to adopt the staff recommended language or in its lieu adopt a sentence instead that says, for the purposes of this subsection, a gift card or a gift certificate is a cash gift. So we will just spell it out either one way or the other. It's the will of the commission which way we want to go. But I just want it clarified.
Colleagues, thoughts?
Well, this is one where I strongly agree with the staff, just because I find specific gift cards to be worthless, something that's annoying to receive. Whereas something that's good anywhere is cash, and it can be used anywhere, and it's you don't have to travel somewhere to use it. And there's a huge distinction between the two. So I agree fully with the staff on this in terms of what's practical.
I have 2 gift certificates in this bag that I've had forever. Because I just, Starbucks, $25, and I don't go to Starbucks, so I just. And another one.
Well, here, to confound things, however, I find it a little more complicated, because a gift certificate to a place you never go from a company or one's great uncle is of very limited value. But if somebody who wants to give you a gift and realizes that there's a way to avoid cash says, I have here 10. Where do you like to go already? And if you go to Starbucks, then that one's handy. If you go to, I won't name names of the record, but if you go to a large department store or the record or bookstore or the dog treat store frequently, then you might say,
Just to pick one of my favorites?
Just to pick one, you might say, oh, I go to that pet
store
frequently.
But it's still
reported. And then you would get it. Then they'd hand you one for a place that you wanted, but it wouldn't count as cash.
But wouldn't it be easier just to hand them the 10 if they're willing to accept the gift anyway?
Yeah, I don't buy
apply.
I don't know how often people actually run into this. I don't know whether we think it's, you know, people are pushing the line, whether this is, I actually hate the whole thing. I wish it, I quite honestly wish it was zero for public officials. So I'm not comfortable in this land and have to figure out the best of an imperfect bargain. Anybody else have some highly personal attitude toward gift cards that we want to turn into public policy?
It's not personal, but yes. I don't really like gift cards either, but I don't think that's the way to make a decision. So I think gift cards are used more and more, and I would say that a gift card is the same as cash.
Gentlemen, want to weigh in on this weighty topic? The question is whether they should be treated as non-cash, the gift of the box of donuts, the handful of flowers,
if you want to make an amendment, this would be the language.
Whether
make
the specific one,
the handwritten,
or whether we should,
instead of this, we would
do that. Sorry, it's hard to hear. Yeah. Okay. So the decision that we have to make is whether gift cards at a specific vendor should be treated as not, specific vendor is a gift other than cash, a negotiable, widely usable gift card would be treated as cash, or whether we should identify all of them as good as cash. Do I hear any comment or a motion on this point?
I'll make a motion. For the purpose of this subsection, a gift card or gift certificate is a cash gift.
Second?
Second.
It's a weighty second.
A comment.
Public comment?
I think you should draw Mr. Givner's opinion into this. What is legally sufficient? Either option?
Yes.
Okay, now the other question is...
Not so weighty.
Did the staff spend a lot of time working up this proposal, and they feel much more strongly about it, perhaps, than the executive director, and they're here now tonight to defend their position, or they're not? You think you want to call them in?
No.
I'm joking. My thought is that I don't know how much thought went into this and whether multiples of the staff met and conferred on this, or, I mean, the executive director knows more about how much thought went into this process.
The executive director happens to be neutral on this issue, but other staff members had reasons for weighing in. But it's a policy consideration, which is why we have these
right.
folks.
Right. I would here. Assume that technically they might be expert on this. Obviously, this has been discussed a few times.
Yeah. I think it's a question of perception. It's
perception.
It's you know, I've in the past I've called it the baseball cap standard. If you give somebody a baseball cap or something of lesser value, it's really unlikely to affect a major governmental decision.
Right.
You know, but when you, anytime you get close to cash, things tend to get a little different. And gift cards are, you know, we just don't. We're almost a cashless society, so credit cards and checks and things like that are bearers of cash, and so you could easily interpret. You know, the American Express or Visa gift card is cash because you could use it at will virtually anywhere. The idea that a $15 gift certificate to Starbucks is going to sway a major decision is a hard sell. But you have to draw the line somewhere. And so we have banged our heads about this for way too long. And just there's not a real answer as to whether a American Express $25 gift card or Starbucks are of equal value.
Right.
and we weighed them and came up with Amex is heavier. But it's not something that I want to spend a whole lot of time in because we're talking about rare instances and small amounts. So I just wanted clarification.
I understood that the key issue was clarity so that people would know what they could and could not do, and you would be able to answer them in a simple way and not have to guess about it. And it's not the $15. It's that when it adds up to 100, then things start to happen. And the question is, at that point, it's not for us to decide whether the 100 is the issue. That decision's already, at least for now, that decision has been made that the public wants that to be a meaningful number. So the 15 is only whether that 15 counts toward the total of what of the number that we have. It was. Have you shared your comments? Is there any other public comment? Nope. Commission, we have a motion made and seconded. Any comment?
It just seems to me that if the $100 is the threshold and you can start handing out $25 gift cards after you've identified what a person's preference is for coffee,
right.
Then we're just creating a loophole. Money.
Right, exactly.
And I think perception.
You got your third vote, I can tell you.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah. I just think perception is critical in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Seeing no further comments, we will vote on the motion to treat all gift cards as cash. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
4-1, that motion carries. Okay. We turn to the minutes of the meeting of September 13th. I thank Vice Chair Harriman for chairing that. And are there any corrections, changes, or clarifications to those minutes?
I move that we adopt the minutes of September 13th.
Second.
Public comment? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Thank you. Mr. St. Croix, would you please, we have your report, which we appreciate. Anything else you'd like to
add? Very quickly, I just want to point out that we did give you an attachment on an update on the spending and public financing at $1,174,000. This was generated last Thursday. We have issued an additional $76,000 in the interim, so there's money kind of flying out. I expect that I'm pretty sure we're going to surpass $2 million of the cost this year, ultimately leaving us $3.3 million for the mayoral race next year. Which does not include the annual $2 million installment. Our estimates that we will need a minimum of $5.4 million for the mayor's race mean that we will start next fiscal year with $5.3 million. I don't think it'll be enough. I think we'll need a supplemental appropriation. But I've already been discussing this at the mayor's office, and they are going to set a certain amount of money aside as they begin to do budget compilations for next year. So that is on their radar. I mentioned earlier that the staff was swamped. I just want to let you all know they're really exhausted. They're working very hard. It's, you know, we're down to the last couple of weeks. They're doing a great job. We're getting a lot of really nice feedback from campaigns. They don't like the laws, they don't like the hoops and, you know, everything else, which is not new, but they do like the way they've been being treated and the way they're being helped. And, so I think we're doing very well with the folks and the candidates. There's some things starting to percolate in terms of stuff we will have to be looking into, which is, of course, the downside of every election. But we're working very hard to police them. Independent expenditures are extremely active. So the auditing staff every day is changing the individual expenditure ceiling per candidates, and you know we attached this from last Thursday. It's completely out of date, but but it's updated every single day at the website. So if you or anybody you know are interested, it's right on the front page, the direct link to the public money spent, the expenditure ceilings in each district. So that information is out there. And yes?
Can I ask a question about IEs? Do we have, I know we have the ceilings, do we have a record of what has been spent in terms of IEs per candidate?
Yes, we have to, because that's the only way we can figure out the ceilings. So
is
people.
On the website or where? Because it's not in here.
Yeah, there's a list of independent expenditures also linked on the website.
Okay.
And it's right there with that other information if you have any trouble finding it. But there's a list of each group that's made an expenditure, how much it was, who they made it on behalf of.
Mm-hmm. Great. And that's updated
daily.
Every day.
Okay. Yeah, and that's coming in every day. That's one of the hardest things to do because there are some third parties making expenditures that don't realize they're supposed to file. So we sort of have a whole network of people citywide making sure that everything they get in the mail, everything that's hung on their doors and everything, we get copies of all of it, check it against what we have filed to make sure that all those expenditures are being reported.
Can you say anything about the proportion of races or candidates who are participating compared to other years, or is that something that we'll look at after the...
That'll be in the analysis that we do post-election. This is as many candidates as we've ever had. And it's certainly the most active election year I've seen in my tenure here. My 2004 was big, but that was there was like 27 candidates in District 5 alone. This year we have 22 candidates in District 10. And it's interesting, too, because when you – this is just from a distance – without breakout candidates in certain races, we start looking for certain behaviors because the people start getting a little desperate. So we're trying to look for red flags and things like that while we do all our other analyses.
So when you say things are percolating that we're going to have to investigate, it's from that work as opposed to complaints or?
Both. It's the time when people like to cry foul. So we certainly don't ignore any of those. But it's also a good time for people to start screwing up, and that's what we're trying to keep them from happening. Candidates and campaigns get a little desperate, and their work starts piling up, and they start cutting corners. So we're watching very hard when people bring their paperwork in to make sure that it's okay, because it's not deliberate in most cases. It's panic, and we don't want that to happen. But this is a good time for that.
We're helping people try to not make mistakes or identify them as they come in.
And one of the reasons the staff is got so much on them is they're trying to stop and look at every paper that comes in and really examine it and not just process it through. We're trying to do as much advance as we can because ultimately if we catch the mistakes quickly, we can fix them quickly. They become more of a problem after the fact.
Anyone else? Any questions for the executive director? Thank you. Would you please convey to the staff our appreciation for all the hard work they're doing during this cycle? And
I appreciate that.
That we respect that these are that they're doing a good job in very difficult times, and we know that they are short-staffed or dealing with some new colleagues, and that must be challenging. So I think I can safely speak on behalf of all of us that we would like to convey that appreciation to them. I hope it'll be possible for them to get a breather afterward, although I realize there's a lot that has to be done. That the work does not end for them on the day after Election Day. But thank you very much. We take public comment on that? Yes. Public comment on the executive director's report, anyone?
I just had one question, and that is on the complaints table on number two, does that include all complaints, or is that non-public financing related complaints or complaints filed by candidates? I see only two additional complaints since the last report, and I'm just wondering if that table reflects all complaints.
I don't know how to answer that without breaking the rules.
Oh, okay. Well, then don't. But I'm glad to hear you're doing concurrent and proactive auditing with the filings.
I can tell you that prior to now, there have been a half dozen campaign-related complaints that have already been
adjudicated.
Yes.
Ah, very good.
So.
Well, that's pretty proactive and concurrent.
Adjudicated is not the right word.
That's very proactive and concurrent. So thank the staff.
If you get there quick enough, you can put the fire out before the kitchen burns down.
Great.
It's a terrible analogy.
No, that's... Commissioners, would anyone like to propose any items for future attention on our agenda beyond the ones that came up in the course of the discussion we've already had this evening?
I just have a question. Are we doing the Sunshine Ordinance issues next in November's meeting? Is that?
That's our intention.
So, okay.
It's depending on the task force's ability to turn them around.
Okay.
Yes. Commissioner Hansen?
Just to follow up on some of the public comment, and maybe you're, when you said aside from the issues that were raised, so maybe you've already got these covered, but one that I noted from Mr. Bartz, when he mentioned that the rent stabilization meetings were not recorded, that's a concern if that's true, and it seems like something we could investigate.
I saw lots of us take notes at that moment.
Okay.
Yes.
So not necessarily for the agenda, but maybe for staff to investigate.
Yes.
Ms. Mayo's comment, which I mentioned earlier,
right.
State
That's
local
the one I was
1.126,
referring to.
And then Mr. Marcello's comment regarding proactive legislation coming from the Ethics Commission, maybe a need for amendment of rules. I am a strong proponent of us proactively doing legislation, so I'm just curious about what the concern is, and maybe that needs to be looked at as well.
Yeah, I thought that one was interesting and was inclined to talk to Mr. St. Croix about that.
Great.
Thank
you.
And come back to you. I think that is a thoughtful suggestion. Anyone else? Okay. Now take public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda. Stalwart advisors, anyone? Thank you very much.
I'll move to adjourn.
Do I hear a second? Unanimously? Come on, a little chorus of seconds. Thank you all. I appreciate it. Thank you for, I think we did well by managing to gather at 6:30. And so remember, it's a 2-hour night for the hour meeting. All in favor of the motion to adjourn?
Aye.
Aye. Sorry.